Always already.
Hello, and welcome to the Always Already podcast. I'm your host, Rachel.
And Sid.
And John.
And we're here today talking about the second section, section two of Rosa Luxemburg's The Accumulation of Capital. So what are we going to talk about, friends?
I think we're going to talk about how it's way too late for any of us to be podcasting, but we're here for you, the listener.
That is 100% true. We're all a little bit exhausted after teaching and doing things at work and trying to imbibe the exact amount of caffeine to stay up for this. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. I don't know what, maybe a place to start in part two of our Rosa Luxemburg mini-series is, well, so let us say to the listeners that if you're not familiar, what happens in the section two of Accumulation of Capital is Luxemburg walks us through a series of economic debates that are tied to existing conditions and also tied to economic theory, both bourgeois and Marxist, from sort of like Say and Ricardo up through the quote unquote Russian legal Marxists in the early 1900s. And she says there are these three rounds of debates and they're kind of all trying to figure out or deal with this question of reproduction, of the reproduction of capital, and so on and so forth. This, Rachel, does that seem like a decent 40 seconds overview of what happens in part two?
Absolutely. Yeah, and connecting it to these various economic crises that take place during each of the debates within economic theory at that time.
Absolutely. So maybe the first question for us then to discuss is, why is it necessary, or why do we think Rosa Luxemburg considers it necessary to go through like kind of arcane and quite intricate and also very shady readings of these various economic debates?
Well, firstly, one way of entering that is I really wish that Rosa Luxemburg had a Twitter account, because I feel like it would have been really fun to read her like terse one-liners thrown at all these different various economists.
Yeah.
But I defer to Sid on this. What do you think, Sid? Why?
No, yeah, I agree. I would love to see a Rosa Luxemburg Twitter, a Marx Twitter, all these great theorists with Twitter accounts. But I think as usual, I don't have an answer, but I have a further question.
Perfect. Always already podcast on.
I guess in a really vulgar way, there seems to be some connection being drawn between material conditions at a specific moment. So like she starts off section two by really talking about the crises of 1815 and 1818-1819 in the UK, and about how that shook up theorists, bourgeois theorists in particular, but basically people who were apologists for capitalism and didn't see anything wrong with the capitalist order, right? So I guess the question that I'm trying to pinpoint is that it seems like there's some connection that she's drawing, or it doesn't seem like she is drawing a connection between the material conditions within which these three series of debates were located in, the theoretical understandings or interpretations of these particular crises and understanding of these crises, and then like political action or the need for socialism. So I guess these three different moving parts seem to play a role in why she's taking us through these different debates. But yeah, thoughts on that.
I think that's totally right. And I think also as it relates to, and I know less about this, but her role in the SPD and the Socialist Party of what she's a part, and trying to ensure that you know, her various contemporaries in the party don't kind of end up writing a certain inevitability into the expansion of capital and capitalism that ends up putting them by default into the kind of bourgeois theorizing, even if it's like inadvertently.
I think that's right. And I mean, I don't think this is a vulgar question at all. Like, I think it's a kind of necessary question of the political, theoretical, economic role that Luxembourg and the party, Luxembourg and Marxists more broadly have taken. And one of the things that particularly struck out to me along this vein is the one of the things that I think Luxembourg is tracing is what she calls, when she gets to the quote-unquote third round of debates among the Russian Marxists, she talks about how, as a result of the, so this is page 191, 192, as a result of the rising working class, because of the class struggle that Europe has been witnessing, because of economic crashes, it was clear that there was no harmony, or that this mythical capitalist harmony was impossible. She says that all these crises and so on have, quote, revealed jarring capitalist antagonisms in their naked reality, end quote. And as a result of that, her conclusion is that, quote, optimism was only possible in the camp of the rising working class and the theorists acting as its spokespersons, right? So it's interesting to me the way in which the there's the kind of like what is one's orientation to these economic crises and conditions, right, plays out both for her on the level of social movements and class struggle and radical movements and so on and so forth, but also at the level of the crash of optimism of bourgeois economists and this quote-unquote rising optimism on behalf of the theorists as spokespeople for the working class.
Right.
I also think there's this interesting, and this might lead us kind of away from the first question, but this interesting tension between internal and external as she traces it through each of them. And so I'm thinking, like, especially about the move she makes in talking about the Russian legal Marxists and the kind of idea of whether or not or to what extent, you know, capitalism can expand in a non... In an economy that's less developed than, let's say, in like in Western Europe or in Britain, right? And so there's that kind of tension too between like to what extent do you consider the internal and the external in the accumulation and expansion of capital in each of these periods and in each of these sets of debates.
That's a totally vital question because, and I'm assuming that Luxembourg has this in mind, those debates and those questions have very real consequences and implications outside of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like teleological, developmental, vulgar notions of Marxism. They're like, no, you choose place. Do you or do you not have to go through capitalist development in the way that Western Europe went through capitalist development, or in a different way, or not at all, in order to then pass on to some additional stage of socialism. And so Luxembourg, though, to me, seems to be saying on the fall on the side of there has to be some kind of capitalist development so as, you know, to release the forces of production, et cetera, in order to then eventually have socialism. I mean, she goes so far in that direction that she'll say, let's see, this is page 208. She says that kind of the only position that is possible if you start from a quote position of skepticism as to the possibilities of capitalist development, end quote. She says that that evinces a fatal logic that can only end up in reactionary utopianism. Mm. And so for her, this is France 1819, Germany 1842, Russia 1893. Now, of course, all of those are European examples, but these sorts of questions that you've raised, Rachel, about the internal and the external, you know, I think the three of us are interested in how those questions that Luxembourg is asking are more global or transnational in their nature.
Yeah, that's interesting. And also, I think it has implications for like the determinism, right, of like, or the inevitability of like capitalism, you know, continuing on forever, and the ability to like have a contradiction within capitalism that will kind of that will work against the tensions within some of these debates that obviate the need for socialism.
Right.
So I'm thinking
in a really presentist mode about like our time and 2019 and the fact that there's been such a renewal both in thinkers like Rosa Luxemburg, but in Marxist thought more generally and anti-capitalist thought more generally in the wake of the financial crisis of 2007-2008. Mm. And it's interesting that in 2016, you had someone like Bernie Sanders, who's no socialist, but whatever, is a social democrat, if I had to classify him. And that he just announced his run again and has raised a lot of money in his first 24 hours. This is what I just read. But it's interesting how these crises, and we're really looking at like starting this part two with a crisis that happened like 200 years ago, or that's where Luxemburg starts with her debate, her evaluation of Sismondi versus like Say and Ricardo, that first round. So I guess I'm just wondering, would you characterize this as a time of optimism, John and Rachel, the way Luxemburg sort of falls, where the bourgeois order or capitalism has been shaken up by these crises and sort of the ugly underside of capitalism has been revealed? We sort of saw some of this with 2007-2008 with Occupy and then Bernie, and now Bernie again, and there's Trump in between that. Do you see crises as being moments of hope?
Yeah. I mean, it depends, but I mean, like, yeah, I do. John, I don't know, before I talk more out loud.
No, I was hoping you were just going to keep doing that. I mean,
or I guess let me put it a bit sharper. More than hope or optimism, do you think it's a generative time for theoretical understandings of, say, the system, broadly construed, and the political possibilities engendered by, say, differing theoretical understandings? And not to, like, make a stark dichotomy between theory and practice, but, like, looking at it dialectically, do you think crises sort of... Like we're returning to Luxemburg, who was writing this about, like, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And right. She's looking at debates that start like 100 years before her and 200 years from us.
Yeah.
So, and we're obviously trying to do something different with Luxemburg. Like Harvey does something which is different, right? He takes her analyses, but then he like sort of adapts it for accumulation by dispossession and his stuff. So I'm wondering, like, in our moment, how does this speak to us, if at all?
Hmm.
To me, this is dulling severely the radical edge of Luxemburg's critique. But what I've been thinking about for the past minute or two is actually the way that, like, something like the work of Thomas Piketty kind of other economists with whom he is in conversation has found its way into something, something like Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax proposal. Which I understand is actually a different answer than either any of the formulations of the questions that were offered. But that is something that I've been thinking about and is something I have been considering as of late. And as you point out, it's hard to ignore the fact that we are recording this the day after Bernie officially declared
again.
I mean, to also not directly answer it, I mean, one thing that comes to mind is, I mean, in Luxemburg's description of Sismondi, who I've not read on my own except for in this section, there's like an ethical emphasis or an emphasis on sort of like the ethical failures of capitalism that I think is really relevant to right now or that we see right now. So even though that's not sufficient, right, for some kind of like, right, you know, overthrow of capitalism, there is sort of like an ethical discussion about the harms it causes in terms of like just gross, undeniable, ridiculous, unsustainable inequality, and also the impact on like the earth through resource extraction. And there's like a moral component to that that I think is also present in kind of the part she highlights of Sismondi's critique.
And then I think the question becomes, what are the available political forms that these ethical critiques or these theoretical attacks on capitalism in a time of crisis, what are the available political forms in the field, to use a Bourdieu term, that can take up some of those critiques and try to enact them in a wider sense? And that is, I think, one probable difference between the one necessarily important difference between Luxembourg and us, in that
right,
there are many active Marxist and or socialist and or social democratic parties,
right, and
Luxembourg herself is part of one, in the time to connect and attach themselves to the intellectual critique.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's really interesting,
that is really
John,
interesting,
because it's sort of what at times, like section one and section two of the accumulation of capital, at times has been a bit of a slog to get through. But it's interesting that Luxembourg is writing as a political activist who's part of a political organization, the SPD, that's actually fighting for a kind of a vision of socialism, of mm-hmm, like Marxist socialism. But how important this theoretical treatise of hers is to that overall political vision in terms of fighting against other forces, both within her party and outside. So it's interesting how theory, or the way we conceive of theory, is so divorced from what you put really well, the political forms that might be mobilizing either those theories, or that might reflect back onto theory itself and helping us understand theory from a different perspective. So I think that difference between her and us is really important, and it sort of really makes clear how important this work is,
yeah,
in its historical context.
But I think also there's something she's doing which is similar to your project, Sid, if I may, which is that in some ways she's like trying to save Marxism or Marxist theories of primitive accumulation or accumulation of capital from their misappropriation by the contemporaries of her time, and also within the SPD, who end up saying like capitalism's not that bad, or like falling towards the reformist side. By the way, Red Rosa has a great accounting of this. It's the Paul Buell, Kate Evans graphic novel. So that's a plug for that. But in thinking about the way now, right, there's like pushback against sort of class reductionist Marxist accounts of the accumulation of capital, right? Mm. Trying to think about things like race and gender. And so I think in that way, like, you know, part of her project is to pull out the potential of Marx to think through the connection between crisis and accumulation from those who are kind of misappropriating it for alternate political ends in her mind.
And also, I think that's precisely right. And also, doing so in a way where Luxembourg is trying to point out where Marx himself falls, right, or where Marx himself in his analysis can no longer provide the necessary theoretical framework or analytical critical purchase on the situation to actually make sense of these dynamics of capitalism and its reproduction and a hopeful eventual revolution to turn to socialism. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, you know, and so then to like, try to do this analogizing that you two are doing between her time and our time, right? That means that when one is, I'm not sure how this analogy works. So let's forget I tried to do that. But, you know, there's something about the way that it's such a critical and self-critical articulation of Marxist thought mm-hmm. that I think adds to its political potency.
Absolutely.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. 100% agree.
Because it's different. And I mean, frankly, we're probably not reading and then this summer going to be writing about this text if it's just like, well, Sismondi got it wrong. And obviously the right, bourgeois economist got it wrong. And like Rod Burtis thought he was doing Marx, but or thought he was going beyond Marx. Really, he was short of Marx. And the Russian Marxists, like they rephrased all of Marx's ideas and that was wrong. And Marx was right all along. Then like we're not reading this book. Today.
Right.
No
right,
one's
right.
reading this book today, right? We just right. go read Marx or whatever, which we right. do anyway. But, you know, so there's, so the temporality of the book is in part dependent on both the critical move that Rachel identified and right. the critical move to be critical of Marx.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's also, I mean, I'm thinking again about this question of today and, so the way I understood some of her critiques of Kirschman and Rod Burtis was that they saw kind of the cause of the crisis in part by the accumulation within a society of only workers and capitalists. And it's interesting because there's been so many kind of critiques and theorizations of neoliberal capitalism that focus on like, you know, kind of the post-Fordist beyond the factory floor, but there's a way in which also the factory floors come back in lately too, I think. And I'm thinking about even Amazon, right? Like on the one hand, it's all about like, you know, the digital and the interaction with like forms of surveillance capitalism and, right. and you know, the digital world in creating value. But then also at the same time, like the actual workers that mm-hmm. do this work, you know, I mean, they're literally on a factory floor and have to like train themselves not to pee, you know, so they can, more labor can be extracted from them. And so I think there's a way in which like these debates between like, to what extent do we emphasize this kind of like contradiction between worker and capitalist and how that causes the crisis of acute, you know, when, how it causes a tension in a crisis related to accumulation can kind of be mapped onto like the question of the factory floor in our contemporary moment as well.
The Amazon distribution facility or whatever is an excellent example to think through Luxembourg right. because it's the factory floor, but it's the distribution that is, but it's the distribution of things that have been produced on a factory floor, right? Not necessarily, right. although Amazon has its own products and brands or whatever, but it's more that we think about the warehouse workers, right, who are like packing and shipping all of the things
yes,
right. that
right.
are not able to that's go to right. the bathroom and are being incredibly oppressively surveilled and so on and so forth. And so it's a slight shift. And I think somewhat consonant with our discussion of the quote unquote service economy or post-Fordism from the part one of the Rosa series. Right. And yet, nonetheless, it still raises some of the precise questions about, you know, even from the first volume of Capital about, no admittance right. or admittance prohibited or whatever it is. That phrase from when Marx in the from when the capitalist enters the factory floor in mm-hmm. volume one. So there's that part of the Amazon example that I think is generative. And then the second part that's generative mm-hmm. is that there are interesting questions about how we think through C plus S plus V in regards to capitalism, mm-hmm. in regards to Amazon, mm-hmm. Amazon's version of capitalism, right? And how we think about mm-hmm. Like the constant capital of Amazon right. and to what extent Amazon perhaps understands the workers as some amalgam between constant capital and wages.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a friend who works in Amazon on the software programming site. And I think he was telling me, I'm not sure about this, but literally all the software folks that they hire are by and large independent contractors. Yeah. So it's not even like Amazon's buying a bunch of constant or fixed capital, whatever, like a big office space. Sure, they have some office spaces, and we just found out that they aren't going to New York after all. But a lot of the people doing the work for Amazon are like independent contractors. So they have their own whatever means of production or whatever, like they have their own laptop and this and that, but they work for Amazon, right? And the other side of the Amazon thing that I'm thinking about is that, one, on software side, they have a bunch of what are called data cleaners doing really repetitive tasks around like online data in the so-called third world. So really programmers that they've hired and outsourced, really like not even coding, but just going through sheets of information and like fixing little errors here and there. So really repetitive, almost like a filing job that needs to be done on a constant basis, but that's outsourced. And then really the goods that are being sold on Amazon, like the clothes, the products, the commodities, the actual physical commodities, like these are also still being produced in a factory, right? Under particular labor conditions. So yeah, I think Amazon's a really interesting example of like certain mutations that are taking place in capitalism, but also certain things that remain constant from when, like, say someone like Luxembourg's talking about.
And the interesting thing about production. Amazon is that most of its, if I'm not mistaken, there was a thing on this on Democracy Now, an interview with one of the a lead organizer who was really involved in helping defeat, you know, or getting Amazon to leave New York City, talking about how the majority of their profits come from contracts with the U.S. government.
Oh, wow.
Not from like the internet and packaging. Like that's only like 15% or something. Don't quote me. I don't know if that's the exact number, but like the majority doesn't actually come from the factory floor. Mm. So I think that that's super interesting too. And I'm just thinking about, I'm thinking more about her critique of the Russian legal Marxists and how there's this way in which, as she describes them, their understanding of capitalism is almost one that could be leveraged by by the right or by capitalists themselves in a way that it's almost like she's trying to underscore how this logic is manipulable by the capitalists themselves or by the bourgeoisie. And I'm thinking about on page 232 to 3, the very end of section 2, and the very top of 233. At issue was whether capitalism was capable of development in general, and in Russia in particular. And the three Marxists corroborated this capacity so thoroughly that they even theoretically demonstrated that capitalism could go on forever. It is obvious that if it is assumed that the accumulation of capital has no restrictions, then the capacity of capital to endure ad infinitum has also been proved. Accumulation is the specifically capitalist method of expanding production, of developing the productivity of labor, of boosting the productive forces, and of economic progress in general. If the capitalist mode of production is able to ensure unconfined expansion of the productive forces and continuous economic progress, then it cannot be overcome. With this, the most important objective pillar of the theory of scientific socialism collapses. Socialist political action and the intellectual content of the proletarian class struggle cease to be a reflection, I skipped a line, of economic processes, and socialism is no longer a historical necessity. The line of argument that starts out from the possibility of capitalism ends up with the impossibility of socialism. But I'm thinking in particular of this line, if the capitalist mode of production is able to ensure unconfined expansion of the productive forces and continuous economic progress, then it cannot be overcome. And I'm thinking again about like this question of the crisis, you know, is this a point of crisis? which I think is like a complicated question, but I do think that if we think about the unconfined expansion of productive forces, right? Like, for example, that it requires land. And then I think about like social movements, right? And the pushing back against the sort of like endless acquisition of land and productive forces that the Amazon example and like them being kicked out of New York pushes back against, or at least demanding a renegotiation pushes back against. So I don't know where I'm going with this, except to think this is where I'm going with this. The sort of like the sort of stock argument of like, well, it's got flaws, but it's the best we got. It's sort of this like fatalistic or deterministic thing. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain determinism, I think, in the Russian legal Marxists too. And both of those ignore kind of like the fissures created by social movements that create like a block within the, as she says, the unconfined expansion of productive forces that create that inevitability.
Right. On the flip side, and I'd love to hear what John thinks of that. I think that part that you read out reveals a certain determinism on Luxembourg's part too.
Huh.
And on the, I guess, the sort of inevitability of socialism.
Huh. True.
That socialism is scientific socialism. The idea that capitalism's contradictions are necessarily going to give way to socialism. That's not to say that the contradictions themselves are just enough. Political action and struggle is completely necessary. But this belief that socialism is coming, right? Which, where we're at now is really interesting because you have people like Bernie Sanders and whatever. Again, he's not a socialist, but you have strong anti-capitalist sentiment, at least, in the core country, basically in the U.S. empire, which is really interesting given that the U.S. doesn't really have a strong history of communist and socialist struggle. It's definitely got a history, but it's not a strong history compared to certain European countries the way Luxembourg was involved. So it's interesting that in that part that you read, there's a determinism on both sides, I think.
Huh, that's like interesting.
One on the Russian legal Marxist side, where they end up proving that, okay, yeah, capitalism can just go on unconfined expansion and reproduction. And Luxembourg saying that as soon as you make that argument, it goes against socialist political struggle. Because it shows that socialism isn't inevitable then.
But how much of that is Luxembourg, and how much of that is Marx himself? Or is that like folded into the idea of like contradictions, the conditions of possibility for capitalism being those which pull it down in the end? Like, isn't that also creating a sort of like scientific, like a determinism?
Right. I think Luxembourg inherits that. Right. I don't know. I might be wrong. John, what do you make of
I think there's undoubtedly determinism within Luxembourg's articulation of the theory. And I'm probably not quite familiar enough with her in order to levy a judgment of how much is it her determinism compared to the extent to which it's kind of taking over Marx's determinism as well. So, but right, I mean, but it's, right. it's unclear to me how to say square that determinism in Luxembourg's thinking in that passage or in several places throughout the text so far with this kind of fine attunement to what are the particular material conditions now and how is economic theory dealing with them? To go back to where we started this conversation at the beginning of the episode, where it seems to me there is much less determinism there kind of over the short term than there is over the long run. So that's one direction that I have thought towards over the past couple of minutes. And then the other is that there's something unique in her thinking where she says it's, or she's perhaps demonstrating that it's easy to consider yourself so critical of capitalism and take that critique to capitalism, but then in doing so, you maybe end up totalizing capitalism so much that you turn it into this thing that can never be torn down. And here, of course, I'm Rachel knew exactly where I was going. I'm sure Rachel and I have never talked about Gibson Graham together. There's a Gibson Graham episode for the listener's reference. So, I mean, that's probably too much of a stretch with Luxembourg herself, but it's one of the things that that passage makes me think about.
Right.
I think that's right. Yeah, no, I mean, that's totally, as you were saying that, I was like, my brain was narrowing in on Gibson Graham. But I guess, so this is like a completely unformed thought. But this also makes me think about this question, the connection between determinism or a deterministic understanding of something and like a theory that ascribes to a certain teleological outcome, firstly, and then how that grates against or stands in tension with like historical materialism or attention to like material conditions, which are always going to be contingent. So like contingency versus like teleology, which are both present in Marx. Right. And obviously Luxembourg takes those up. And so if that's like partly what we're getting at is how both of those are baked into Marx himself.
Yeah, that's great. That's I don't know what to say to that.
This is the second time that we've been talking where I've thought of the same person and the same same idea, and that's Chakrabarty's Two Histories of Capital, right? And that in some ways, when we were talking at the beginning of the episode about theory and practice and about the internal external stuff, and then now again here with this question of determinism, right? I mean, I absolutely love that chapter from Provincializing Europe from Chakrabarty, and the tensions that he draws out between, as you put it, Rachel, the determinism and then the contingency, or the determinism or in teleology and the thing that is incommensurable with that teleology, is something I am wondering if we could get to via Luxembourg, or if there is too much determinism in Luxembourg to get to the more indeterminate approach that Chakrabarty offers, if that's a reasonable reading of Chakrabarty, even.
Yeah, that is. By the way, John, that reminds me, we met in that.
You're
Marx
right.
Class
where we
Carol's
where
Marx
we read
class.
The I suggested I think we read that Chakrabarty to
and
her.
I presented on the Chakrabarty
full circle
in
full
that
circle,
class, and I still have my from that, and I think. Like what? 5 years? 4 years?
Oh my gosh!
No, 5 years ago. 2014.
Yeah, at least 5 years ago.
Yeah, spring 2014. Wow, full circle. We're still on Marx.
We're still talking about Marx and Chakrabarty, and now we got Rosa with us too.
Right. Okay, John. So I thought that's history one and history two. The Chakrabarty thing really, I think, gets at that tension between teleology and contingency. And I guess I'm wondering something else that just struck me about that passage that Rachel just read is that Luxembourg's insisting, and I don't know if this is there in Marx, but she's insisting that there are restrictions to capital accumulation, right? And I think this is what's going to set us up for part three, where there's all like, I mean, this is me just vulgarizing her argument, but about there being an outside to capitalism and that capitalism requires that outside. So it constantly expands into territories that are external to it. And then it internalizes these, but at some point it runs out of that external to capitalism thing. Or I think that's what she says. And she's like, at that point, there's a major crisis, or that's really problematic for the system. So I think it's interesting, this idea that there are restrictions to capitalist growth, to accumulation, to expanded reproduction. And I think we're coming up on one of these major restrictions with climate change and the ecology more generally. But at the same time, then you have things like digital capitalism that expand, and I'm using the word deliberately, a new frontier. A new frontier opens up, right? And if you see one of the leading capitalists of the world, Bezos, he didn't know what to do with his money, so he was thinking about going and exploring Mars.
I think colonize was the word.
Or colonize Mars. Yeah. So like frontiers, new frontiers, colonizing new territories, space. So does capitalism run up against limits, or does it reconfigure and mutate to create new outsides? Or
doesn't
whatever?
This go back to Gibbs and Graham and not thinking about capitalism in one way, like some kinds of or some forms of capital are more adaptable than others, right? And like thinking about like, or not some forms of capital, some forms of like the not the means of production. What would you call land? Like
factor of production.
Factor, yeah. Right. Some factors of production are more exhaustible than others.
Right.
And so I think like, what would it look like if the, you know, like the kind of, and then there's such a connection between them too, which I think like feminist critiques of like, you know, the, you know, Silicon Valley, for example, are really helpful in pointing out that there's like a materiality to the digital too, like the making of switchboards and all these other things. Right.
Totally,
and so I think like that actually goes against what I was starting to say, which is thinking about divergent factors of capitalism, right? And factors of production, excuse me, that are differentially exhaustible.
Right. Mm, that's really good, Rachel. Yeah. And Luxembourg is useful here as well in the way, to go back to a point you made a while ago, Rachel, that you don't want to end up at the point at which you inadvertently say that, well, capitalism could just go on forever and ever, which is not what either of you are doing, right? But that's one direction in which it is possible to take. It's like, well, you know, is to just assume that that's the case. And I have plenty of my moments in my life where I'm just like, ah, oh, fuck, it's just capitalism. I'm just going to keep going the way it is. And like, what the fuck can we do about it?
Usually after conversations with people who say, but look what happened in Russia.
Venezuela.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So, I was just totally derailing.
No, I mean, it just like brought up our,
By the way, speaking about digital capitalism and all of that, I want to give a shout out to John and Amy for their article on, John, do you want to, on Alexa?
Yes, on Amazon's Alexa and Google Assistant and those sorts of things, vis-a-vis, relevant actually in an idea that I thought about earlier, because Amy Schiller, friend of and guest on, previous guest on the podcast, and I have been working on revisions on this article. We've been working a lot with the wages for housework movement and thinking about the concept of the social factory coming out of them and from autonomous Marxists. And, you know, when we talked about,
I can't wait.
Probably the most funly written thing that I've ever been a part of. Although a lot of that was Amy, but not me, with her writing skills. So, but yeah, I mean, and this in some way returns us to the question of the Amazon factory floor, right? And the circuits that are created to try to maintain a set of expanded reproduction such that Alexa becomes a mode of friendly inculcation and further luring into networks of inflows of capital. Right. Who can also, you know, play music for you and keep track of your shopping list and help you buy the bougie coffee off of Amazon or whatever.
God, so creepy.
Right.
That's incredibly creepy.
So, yeah, coming soon to, I believe, June will be this article. I'm sure that
I'm so excited.
We'll be tweeting
and
about it.
I'm teaching a capitalism and feminism class in the fall, so I'll have to include that in
thank you.
Ah, I'm very excited. So I'm interested in kind of like the one lingering question for both of you that arises after you've read this, like the kind of open question that you're left pondering that connects, like your takeaway curiosity.
I've got one, but I was just rambling about stuff. So Sid, you should go first.
I guess takeaway curiosity. So there are these lines throughout, and I sort of know where she's going with this, but I find this really interesting, and it's largely in the first debate with Sismondi versus everyone. But she keeps asking, and neither Sismondi nor Say or Ricardo or McCulloch or any of them can give a good answer. And the question is, I'm on page 129, she says, where is the market for capitalized surplus value? And she keeps asking about, like, where is the market for these products? Like, when there's overproduction, who's going to buy these products if workers' wages are low? And capitalists themselves aren't just buying all of this up, right? And like, I know from reading Harvey that way of going about an understanding of crises wasn't exactly correct. Like for Harvey, it's about overaccumulation. Whereas for Luxembourg, her main thing turns on underconsumption.
Mm-hmm.
And so next time we'll get into that more. But yeah, so I'm wondering how that shift from underconsumption to overaccumulation, though Harvey doesn't dwell on it, I'm wondering if that changes our political analysis in any way, because it doesn't seem like it does. Like it seems like we still need everything that Luxembourg's talking about, in terms of like political action and the need for socialism and to really like, highlight the, I guess, limits to capitalist growth. So even though by our contemporary standards, some of Luxembourg's theoretical analyses were a bit off, her political prescriptions still hold weight, or a lot of weight. So yeah, I don't know if that's a question, but that's a tension that I'd love to, I guess, explore more. Yeah, that's mine.
This is an excellent question, Rachel. I love this question. And Sid, that is a wonderful articulation of your lingering curiosity.
John, you're so supportive.
mine is, I think, connected to Sid's, and that is that it's perhaps has kind of two facets to it. One facet is just in terms of a piece of thinking and theorizing and analysis, I am interested in the, or I'm intrigued by where the arc from these getting, for me, not for her, but for me, getting bogged down in these debates, because it's actually quite lively. It's lively writing, even though it's like really dense, somewhat arcane economic debates that are important, but arcane. And I think it's possible to be both of those things.
Right.
The trajectory of her getting us from there and thus getting political movements from these economic analyses to the thinking about original accumulation and thinking about imperialism and what that arc of analysis and argumentation and writing is going to be. Like that, the how is she doing that? I'm intrigued by as a lingering curiosity. And perhaps the second facet of that is where it's a little bit more, kind of more specific to what Sid was talking about, is that I've been kind of tracing, I mean, having a vague idea, vague idea of where she's going to end up. Her occasional discussions of what the quote unquote world market is doing, figuring into all of these different economic theories. My other curiosity is what the distinguishing characteristics of her analysis of trade, imperialism, and the quote-unquote world market are compared to the ways that all these other theorists have improperly try to use some notion of a world market to explain that problem of capitalism. Where is the market for capitalized surplus value going to come from?
Right.
So that's my lingering curiosity.
Wow.
Rachel, what's your lingering curiosity?
I have a lot. I guess mine's really different. So I saw Fiddler on the Roof 2 weekends ago.
I'm excited to see where this is going.
Which I love Fiddler on the Roof. I grew up like singing all those songs by heart. So it was like really fun. But it was interesting kind of like seeing the politics in it in a different way this time. But all that's to say, so it's about like kind of the pushing out of the Jews within the Pale of Settlement during the Tsars pushing out of the Jews in the Pale of Settlement at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, so like 1905. And so I guess I've been thinking about, I'm like really, really intrigued by the Russian legal Marxists in relationship to this question of Russian imperialism, and like the fate of particular populations, like the Jews, and how like some of them turn towards like the kind of Bundist uptake of, these values that they ascribe to, but then go a different way than, you know, Rosa Luxemburg is obviously wants them to. And so, this is obviously like before, right? Marx is writing about the period right before this. And so I'm thinking about sort of that 1905 period from both ends and kind of trying to situate the Russian legal Marxists vis-a-vis the kind of exclusionary and violent politics of the Russian Empire at that moment. So that's where my mind went.
Wow. Which is particularly relevant for the very expansive connections we are going to be making using this Luxemburg text when we are writing together this summer.
That is very
so
true.
It's interesting and in how point. Like so like that into that lingering curiosity of yours, Rachel, I think kind of prefigures some of the writing we will and thinking we will be doing
that's
together.
Right.
Quite a good point. Wow. Well, I'm excited for all of those things.
Yeah, I hope the listeners are excited for part three of the Rosa
as
Luxemburg podcast.
We are.
Yeah. I'm very excited about part three. I feel like it's been building up, and we've been getting like a flavor of it through these two sections, part one and part two. But yeah, I'm really excited for part three.
And it's also been this, like reading Marx himself has been it trains you how to think and how to read it as you do the act of reading and thinking about it, right? Which I appreciate a text that does that as it goes. Intentional or not, like, we're probably never able to decide that with any sort of finality, but to me, this Luxemburg text has that effect.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
All right.
Wow.
We did it.
Well, this has been awesome,
this
guys.
Has.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing Rosa with me.
Yeah. And so we'll reconvene in, I don't know what, probably like month and a half to do the next installment of Accumulation of Capital miniseries.
That sounds great.
Yeah, that sounds great.
And this is the real juicy part, so this is going to be really good.
Yeah, it's going to be a 17-hour-long podcast, so get ready.
17 hours. Get ready. Talk about caffeine.
Well,
by the way, before we forget, as a closing note, John, do you want to read that last line of section two?
Oh, that's thank you for the reminder, Sid. Because I meant to say, regardless of where else we ended, we had to get this line in. let's see. All of the three Marxists, this is page 233, all of the three Marxists considered here demonstrated in their own person just how flimsy and specious were the new attempts to establish the grounds for socialism. No sooner had they refounded socialism than they proceeded to turn their backs on it. While the Russian masses were risking their lives in the struggle for the ideals of a social order that is due, one day, to put the end, humankind, before the means, production, quote, the individual, end quote, ran for cover in the bushes and found philosophical and ethical solace with Kant, the Russian legal Marxists ended up in practice where their theoretical position led them, in the camp of bourgeois, quote unquote, harmonies. And so, listeners, we, Sid, Rachel, and I hope you sleep well in cover in the bushes, finding ethical and philosophical solace with Kant, as the Russian legal Marxists did.
Wow. John, that was
poignant.
That
I
was
know.
Yes, to raise his tone. Throw in a pretentious French phrase.
So, yeah, that's I think the memory I want to leave the listener with.
I 100% concur.
Yes,
that's awesome.
All right, listeners, thank you, Rachel and Sid. Thank you.
Thank you,
John. Thank you, Sid. Thank you, listeners.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.
This has been lovely.
And as Emily Crandall would say, have an always already day.
Have an always already day. Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Thank you, listeners, once again for joining us on the Always Already podcast, which is created by Sid Asar, James Paladini Jr., Rachel Brown, Emily Crandall, Billy Altman, and John McMahon. Visit our website, alwaysreadypodcast.wordpress.com. Email us, text you'd like us to discuss, advice, questions to answer, and dreams to analyze to alwaysreadypodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @alwaysreadyon. Like us on Facebook, subscribe to us in iTunes or on Stitcher, and leave us a good review while you are there. You can support the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/alwaysreadypodcast. This, of course, is a wonderful time to shout out all of the lovely sponsors and brilliant sponsors we have in the Always Already Circle of Trust, which has access to benefits that not many of you have claimed, so feel free to send us a message. We'd like to thank Matt, David, Stephanie, Laura, Ludwig, Andrew, Bakalan, Roddy, Diane, Ariel, Kristen, Catherine, and Matthew. In the Friend of the Podcast tier, we would like to thank Ian, Thomas, Bill, the Theory Talk Podcast, Daniel, and Rachel. And in the No Reward, but somebody we are thankful for, we appreciate your support, Guava. Thank you to previous guest and friend of the show, Bad Infinity, for their song Post Digital, which you heard at the beginning of the episode. And of course, Always Already, thank you to Bee, whose cover of Landslide you're listening to right now. Till next time, have an Always Already day.